where Alcoa, Rio Tinto Alcan, and other international aluminum companies have major operations. Ophelia Quistarton, NPR News, Dakar.
The Pentagon is set to announce the deployment of at least one more combat brigade to Afghanistan in the coming weeks as part of an expected buildup of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. Officials say there will likely be one more Army brigade and one Marine regimental combat team ordered to Afghanistan by the summer. At least one of those is expected to be announced shortly after the first of the year. Defense Department officials have also confirmed earlier reports that a combat aviation brigade will head to Afghanistan early next year. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from iShares, offering exchange-traded funds. Let's build a better investment world. iShares.com/betterworld.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring holiday gift ideas like imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, gift baskets, and gift certificates, along with party catering. World Harvest Foods, located at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign. Support for today's broadcast comes from Furniture Lounge Consignment Gallery, 126 West Main Street in Urbana. Furniture Lounge Consignment Gallery accepts consignments of quality gently used furniture and home decor. More information is available in the store or at 217-344-1500.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Before we begin this hour, I'd just like to bring you a quick update on a story that we have been following here in the state of Illinois over the last couple of weeks. Federal prosecutors are asking the Illinois House Impeachment Committee not to dig into criminal charges against Governor Rod Blagojevich. In a letter released today, U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald says the panel could significantly compromise, those his words, his investigation by interviewing Blagojevich aides about possible crimes. Fitzgerald is also declining to provide information about his investigation, such as the identities of people mentioned in a criminal complaint. But the prosecutor does say that he hasn't ruled out giving the committee copies of Blagojevich conversations caught on wiretaps. The committee is supposed to recommend whether the full House consider impeaching the governor. Members had sent a letter to Fitzgerald asking for guidance on whether to look into the criminal allegations. That's what we have on the story right now. Certainly throughout the day, as this develops, if there's more, we'll have it as part of our newscasts and maybe also as part of the news from National Public Radio. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about politics in Thailand. After months of protests and a week-long occupation of Thailand's main international airport, the country now has a new prime minister. He is, in fact, the third leader for the country in the past 4 months. There would have been five in a little over the last 2 years, so that tells you something about a kind of a political unrest that's been going on in Thailand over the last couple of years. The new prime minister is a British-born economist, someone who has a reputation of being free of any charges or allegations of political corruption, but he is certainly facing a big challenge, leading a country that remains politically divided and, like a lot of countries, trying to deal with the downturn in the world economy. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about what lies ahead for the new Thai government, and our guest is John Brandon. He is the director of the Asia Foundation's International Relations Programs, as well as the associate director of their Washington, D.C. office. He is a Southeast Asia specialist by training. His opinion pieces on the region have appeared in a number of places, including the International Herald Tribune, the Christian Science Monitor, the L.A. Times, and other papers around the country. He's also written about Burma. He's the editor of Burma, Myanmar, Towards the 21st Century, The Dynamics of Continuity and Change, that published in 1997, and also a contributor to Burma Prospects for a Democratic Future, published by the Brookings Institution in 1998. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone who is interested in calling and joining the conversation is welcome to do that. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Brandon, hello.
Yes, good morning, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We'll have to, I'm sure, do some background here for those people who don't follow Thai politics. But it seems that perhaps the place to start, because what this apparently, as I understand it, sort of comes down to is a struggle between the opposition and people who were supporters of a former prime minister, going back a couple. Maybe the thing to do would be to talk a little bit about Thaksin Shinawatra, the man who was the prime minister from 2001 until 2006, when he was removed in a military coup. Maybe you could talk a little bit about him and about his rise and fall.
Surely. As you said, that former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat was Prime Minister from 2001 to 2006. He founded a political party called the Thai Rak Thai Party in the late 1990s. And his party came to power in 2001 with a resounding victory. It was the first time in Thailand's parliamentary history that his party won an outright majority without trying to patch together other political parties to come in and form a coalition government. He was extraordinarily popular with in rural areas, particularly in the northeast, which is the largest region of Thailand, and most people there are farmers, and it's also the poorest part of the country. He is from the northern part of the country in a city called Chiang Mai, and the second largest city in Thailand, and his political base there. And even in the beginning, he was popular in both rural and urban areas, but while in power, the urban middle class, many in the business class, people in civil society organizations, began to feel disenchanted because he was emasculating the independent agencies that had been created under the 1997 Constitution, and felt that he was abusing his power. And over time, his power eroded, but still was able to maintain a significant base in rural areas that, while he might not have had an outright majority, in the end, he had a significant plurality.
So his party was the Thai Rak Thai. Then after that, there was another party that I think a lot of people said, well, essentially that's the same party, the People Power Party. And now we have another party, the For Thailand Party. And I think all along what is the issue here that the party changes its name, but essentially when you look at the people who are running the party and representing the party, it tends to be the same people?
Yes. How that worked was that in 2006, the Thai Rak Thai Party was disbanded, and about 111 people, including Thaksin Shinawat, were banned from politics by the country's constitutional court. They found that the Thai Rak Thai Party engaged in massive voting irregularities and illegalities, and so there's the party was permanently disbanded. Those 111 people were banned from politics for 5 years. But what you had is that those still left in the party were able to regroup, and the Constitution doesn't say that you can't, you know, regroup and call your go under a different name. So it then became the People's Power Party. The former Thai Rak Thai people supported other people who were supporters of Thaksin to run for office, and they won. And earlier this month, the People's Power Party was disbanded for election irregularities, including the most recent prime minister before the one that just came into office on December 15th. Again, they regrouped, and instead of being called the People's Power Party, they've become the Pua-Thai. But what's different from their predecessors is that they are now in the opposition where they were once in the majority. Mm-hmm. But they are a significant opposition.
Thaksin Shinawat, he was scheduled to go on trial for political corruption this past summer. He left the country. He's and fled to Britain, and presumably he's still now living in Britain.
Not exactly. He was he was convicted on I believe two counts of corruption, both him and his wife. Mm. And he was in convicted in absentia. In other words, he skipped bail. He was in Britain. He owns a British football or soccer team, Manchester City. But he has since left Britain. They did not extend, the British government did not extend his visa. So he has been sort of in limbo. He has been living in Dubai, in the Middle East, in Hong Kong, and in China. And he's been sort of shuttling around, but communicating with people in Thailand from either of these countries. And in fact, in one, in a couple of instances, in rallies, he has been pre-recorded to speak to his supporters in Bangkok and elsewhere, and tens of thousands of people have heard him. So even though he's out of the country, it should be noted that he maybe, at least at one time, he was the country's richest person, worth about $2 billion. And so, but his assets have been tied up. He's also divorced. He and his wife have divorced. And some people are wondering if that's just sort of some ploy to sort of skip around to be able to, you know, protect the money that they have left. But I'm not quite sure of that.
Well, let me ask you one other quick question, then I have a caller here. I promise this person will get to them. In between Thaksin Shinawat and the new, just recently sworn in prime minister, we had two other guys. One of them, the last, who happens to be Thaksin's brother-in-law, was chosen to be prime minister just in September, so he wasn't there very long. The two of them, were they both essentially just seen as being his men?
Yes, they were. For a 3-month period, there was a group called the People's Alliance for Democracy, and in late August, organized and protested, and they were so effective that they were able to take over Government House, is where the Prime Minister, his office is and resides. And it's like the equivalent of protesters in the United States taking over the White House. They lived there for 3 months. The Thai government had to be moved its offices and held its cabinet meetings in the old international airport, about 20 to 25 miles from the center of town. And so, and they were largely calling for, and what they've gotten is that the People's Power Party and those affiliated with the party no longer be in the majority, and that they step down and no longer head the government. People viewed both former Prime Minister Samak and Prime Minister Somchai, the most recent Prime Minister, as being just proxies of former Prime Minister Thaksin.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is John Brandon. He is director of the Asia Foundation's International Relations Programs, as well as the associate director of the Washington, D.C. office. He is a specialist in Southeast Asia by his training, and we're talking this morning about Thailand and recent events there. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone in Wellington on our toll-free line, and we'll talk with them. Line 4, hello.
Yes, I find this kind of interesting because my brother and his wife are hosting for this school year a Thai teacher in their home, and we met her at Thanksgiving when she's here, and she'll be in our home again for Christmas. And we were, of course, at Thanksgiving time, well, this newest prime minister wasn't in yet, but there was, you know, the airports were being held hostage, so to speak. And we were kind of quizzing her about it, and, you know, this was kind of her take on it. She said, well, the exiled prime minister and the guy that's kind of the head of the opposition party forces at this point, she said they were best friends for years and years and years until a couple of years ago when the guy ousted them, and she felt that there was some sort of personal animosity that had arisen that was giving rise to the political end of it at this point.
I think your Thai friend is correct that Sondi Limtongkun, who headed one of the leaders of the People's Alliance for Democracy, he's a media mogul, was close to Thaksin for a period of time, and they did have a falling out. And I think that combined with other people in Thailand who were feeling that Prime Minister Thaksin was abusing his power, as I mentioned earlier on in this program, the independent agencies that had been created by the 1997 Constitution were basically emasculated under Thaksin. The Counter-Corruption Commission, National Election Commission, number of other independent bodies, and they were put in with Thaksin's people, and that he, for a period of time, was really controlling everything, and it was viewed that he it was almost like by fiat, and that the opposition was not able to be effective in expressing its concerns over these constitutional abuses of power. So I think it goes beyond Sondi Limtongkun, but yes, that they were friends at one period of time.
Well, I thank the caller for the story. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. To me, I think one of the things that's striking is that after the level of protest that you talked about, the protesters occupying which is in effect the White House of Thailand. So the government actually had to move, and then people certainly heard the coverage of the occupation of the airport that had really serious consequences for the country's economy, that the government didn't take more aggressive action toward the protesters. That seems to me remarkable, that essentially the government and the military pretty much left them alone.
Yes, it's from an outside view, it is remarkable. But if you look at when Thaksin Shinawat was removed in September of 2006, the military took over temporarily and was in power for about a 15-month period until the elections of December 2007. That period of time when the military ruled was viewed as ineffective by virtually all segments of Thai society. It started out initially where people were pleased, but over time people became more disenchanted by the way that they were governing. And they knew that if they were to try to use extra constitutional means again to remove this government, they would be viewed as widely unpopular. The other thing is that people would most likely protest and fight back. There could have been violence and significant loss of life. And that was something they didn't want to do. But I think this is reflective of a deeper underseeding of political divisiveness in Thai society between those who are supporters of Prime Minister Thaksin and his populist policies, and those who did not favor the policies of Thaksin Shinawat and his abuse of power.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the man who now is the new prime minister. It seems, having read about him, that in many ways he is quite different from certainly from the three men who came before him.
Yes, he is. His name is Apisit Vejjajiva. He was elected last week, brought into power. He's 44 years old. He may be Thailand's youngest prime minister, if not the youngest, certainly one of the youngest. He is earned his PhD, graduated with honors in economics from Oxford University, so he's a trained economist. He is very articulate, intelligent, and urbane. He is going to have a challenge in terms of how to enable Thailand to sort of economically rebound when there are global economic forces at play that are larger than what Thailand can control, coupled with the difficulties such as the closing of the airport and how that's impacted on weak investor confidence in the country.
Now, Mr. Apisit and his supporters managed to put together enough votes for him to become prime minister. So that would be his supporters and perhaps people who just didn't like Mr. Thaksin and his circle, and then perhaps people also who were supporters of Thaksin Shinawat, who saw which way the wind was blowing and said, well, okay, for right now, we'll go with the opposition and the opposition leader. There seemed to be, in a lot of things that I've read, though, some question about truly how much support Mr. Opposite has and, in fact, how long his government can last and how long this coalition can hold together.
That's correct. Prime Minister Opposite leads the Democrat Party. It's the oldest party in Thailand. It was founded in the 1930s. They have about 166 members in Parliament. They've had to patch together an additional about 70 seats to have the majority right now. A major reason why he was able to patch this coalition together is that there was a power broker that was formerly with the Thai Rak Thai, a gentleman by the name of Naywin Chitjob, who actually was officially banned from politics, but he brought about 23 members from former Thai Rak Thai, People's Power Party people, over to the Democratic Party. To the coalition, and so the Democrats could create a government. Now, this could change even as early within the next couple of months. The reason is that when I mentioned how the Constitutional Court disbanded the People's Power Party, it left about 29 seats that people all in the People's Power Party, there needs to be another election. So there's going to be a by-election to fill those seats. Most of them are in rural areas and power base of former Prime Minister Thaksin. So if those 29 or 30 seats are taken back over, it could upset Prime Minister Opposite's coalition, and you could wind up seeing the Pua-Thai back into power if people feel that they're not getting enough right now in terms of what they feel is politically beneficial to them, people in the coalition. And if that happens, then you've come full circle and you have this stalemate. Prime Minister Opposite is trying to keep the coalition together. People who were in the former cabinet that are still in politics have been allowed to keep their cabinet seats, and one of those seats is Minister of Transportation. That's very important because, in terms of trying to get Thailand to economically rebound, the country is willing to invest largely in infrastructure projects. That's a lot of money going in there to try to develop the country's infrastructure, and that means people in that position will have significant influence
because of all the money that they have to hand out.
And that too. And also, Prime Minister Opposite, that's a good point. He has retained many of the populist and indeed popular policies of former Prime Minister Thaksin in terms of the village development schemes for all of the 70,000 villages in Thailand, public health care system where if you pay the equivalent in this country of about 70 cents, you get free medical care whether you have a cold or whether you have cancer.
We have another caller here. We'll talk with someone next in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. What role does the – is it the royal family? Is that right? How is that referred to?
The royal family, Thailand is a constitutional monarchy, and it's headed by a king.
Okay. In the past, hasn't the king played some role in this or not, in terms of intervening?
Yes, there has been a history of that. King Bhumibol Adulyadej is the world's longest-serving monarch in history. He has been on the throne in Thailand for 62 years. He superseded Queen Victoria's reign from the 19th to early 20th century. King Bhumibol has been during times of political crisis, the ultimate arbiter. There are times where he intervened in the 1970s and in the 1990s to strongly encourage the conflicting sides to come to some accommodation. And there have been times where he has sided with the military, where he thought that that brought the country stability. Actually, twice. One time he sided with student protesters who basically usurped three military dictators that headed the government in 1973. But then he sided with the military in 1976 and in stability. At that time, Thailand was facing a communist insurgency and a number of things, and it was the Vietnam War had just ended. It was a very unwieldy time and turbulent time in the country's history. And then there were other times where he had the military and proponents for democracy meet and resolve an issue that transited to a more democratic form of government after there was some violence in 1992. He did not intervene this time, and some people probably question what does this mean. By him not giving his annual birthday message, the reason was that he was ill. He had a throat infection. I don't doubt the king is 81 years old. He may be, he's not considered to be in robust health. At the same time, I think King Bhumibol is probably thinking that there have to be institutions in Thailand, judiciaries, legislatures, civil society in general, that need to be more mature, and that they need to go through the growing pains that any country faces when trying to embark on democratic reform, for them to resolve those issues, to be able to, do that, because rather than to have someone like himself remain. Also, getting involved in politics for a monarch sometimes can be viewed as sullying the institution, and he doesn't want to interfere when he feels not necessary.
Hmm. One of the things that I found interesting was, given the fact that, as you say, in the past there have been times when the king has stepped forward to try to resolve some kind of political struggle, and this time he didn't, other than now, recently he said he hoped now that there would be peace in the country now that there has been at least this most recent resolution and we have a new government, have a new prime minister. The thing that interested me is that apparently the queen did make public statements and came out essentially in support of the protesters and of the people who had occupied the airport.
One of the protesters back in October, that there was some violence, and there were a handful of people killed over a number of incidents. And the Queen and the palace did pay for that person's funeral. And then someone said, the Queen is on our side. And then immediately they began paying hospital bills for people like policemen and all who had been injured in the fray. And so I think what they were trying to do was to engage in acts of kindness. But as I said, the monarchy is not something where traditionally they like to get, very engaged in the day-to-day affairs of politics. And so there may be some sympathies there, but I think that the more important issue is, what do a lot of Thai people think? And I think maybe the average Thai person was becoming rather disgruntled with all the bickering going on with both sides. And essentially what they want is a government that is capable of promoting economic policies that will allow them to grow, to be able to create jobs, to be able to provide services, and to be effective. And so I think that's the more important and larger issue.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is John Brandon. He's the director of the Asia Foundation's International Relations Programs. He's also associate director of the Washington, D.C. office. He is an Southeast Asia specialist by his training. We're talking this morning about Thailand and what has been happening there over the past few months. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there had been, that in the past, when there were times of political unrest, there were sometimes interventions or at least statements made by the king. And also there certainly were involvement by the military. You also talked about the fact that here recently people in the country have seemed to have lost confidence in the military and its ability to be able to do things. At the same time, I think that when Mr. Apisit became prime minister, there were people, and perhaps these were the people who were the supporters of Thaksin Shinawat, who said, well, this guy, he's the army's candidate. This is the military's prime minister. They're behind this guy. Can you say that they have been, were they involved in this, or would you just say that maybe that they would be happy to see things at least resolved and would be waiting to see what would happen with this new government?
I believe that the Thai military was pleased to see that the protests have abated, that this government has been able to come to power and to hopefully have the chance to be able to develop policies that will allow them to govern effectively. At the same time, there are people who possess views saying that from behind the scenes, though the military may have been discredited in governing on a day-to-day basis, they did have influence in seeing how the current government is configured. And so there might have been some behind-the-scenes maneuvering, but I'm not privy to such such matters.
Mm-hmm. How serious, how damaging to the Thai economy was the airport occupation?
Significant. Tourism is a major industry in Thailand. It represents 6% of the country's gross domestic product. It brings in about $16 billion a year. The loss of this in just the last couple of months or so, I believe that tourism will be hurt, and this is the height of tourism season. You know, it's winter, here, and I know the weather is very cold in Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. You have beautiful beaches there, warm climate, and they have people who come from all over the world. And now they're expecting tourism to drop, perhaps by as much as half. This year, it was estimated about 14 to 15 million people would visit Thailand. Next year, they're thinking it might be as low as 7.5, so by 50%. And this could mean the possible loss of 1 million jobs in the tourism industry. And so that has a significant impact. The other thing is that Suvarnabhumi Airport, the airport that was taken over, the cargo that goes in and out of Suvarnabhumi Airport, it's a hub. Bangkok is a hub in Southeast Asia. It carries about 3% of the world's cargo. And so the government estimated it was losing $85 million a day in lost revenue. So in just over a week, they lost over $500 million. But if you look at how people from the outside look at this, thinking, is this a safe place to visit? Is this a safe place to invest? Thailand is going to have a difficult time when you couple that with the global economic downturn in this country and people thinking, I don't want to spend a lot of money. They're worried about job security, whether they would be able to finance such a trip to go, at least from this part, from the United States, halfway around the world. It's going to hurt their pocketbook.
Hmm. You know, you could you wonder how it is that the PAD decided to do this. I suppose you can understand that they would think, well, this would be something very, very dramatic, and it would be the kind of thing that would certainly get the attention of the government. On the other hand, you might think that they would consider just how damaging that it could be to the Thai economy. Now, perhaps they didn't think that it would go on as long as it did. And I wonder if you have any particular insight about that particular question, that is, how they thought about what this was going to do if it went on more than a day or two.
Well, what they wanted to do is that they wanted to humiliate the government even further. Mm-hmm. At the time that they took over Suvarnabhumi Airport, then Prime Minister Somchai was attending an APEC leaders meeting, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum. They hold an annual meeting of all APEC leaders, which includes President Bush, in Peru. And Prime Minister Somchai was there. They closed down the airport before Prime Minister Somchai could return. And in fact, his plane had to be diverted to Chiang Mai. And so they were looking to show that this was a government that was ineffective and that there was no confidence in that he and his cabinet needed to step down. That was the major demand of the People's Alliance for Democracy, a complete capitulation by Prime Minister Somchai and his cabinet. And in that regard, they achieved that. But what are the economic costs to that? Was that really thought out? Did they think this would only take 2 days and not seven? Those are legitimate questions. And the government that they have now, which they obviously are satisfied with, and that they want Prime Minister Opposite to lead, that government inherits these problems. And how they deal with that will be a significant challenge. Mm.
I'm just wondering, maybe you could talk a little bit more about the nature of the importance of the urban-rural kind of division that we've talked about. The fact that the former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra always is and was very popular in the rural areas of the country. That's where his base of support is, and that as far as the opposition is concerned and Mr. Opposite, that perhaps his strength tends to be more among urban elites. Is that that split an important one in Thailand and something around which political conflict centers?
In my view, yes. I don't believe that this is going to go away. I hope, at least though, for now, that there's the country is allowed to have a breathing period to be able to see how Prime Minister Opposite is able to govern with this new coalition. And the two things, challenges that Prime Minister Opposite has, is to be able to improve the economy, and he's going to have to. He has agreed, and this is part of being able to keep the coalition, some of these populist policies that former Prime Minister Thaksin initiated. So keeping the policies of the health care scheme, the village development fund, debt moratorium for farmers, but particularly in this instance, those farmers that were affected by flooding, recently. And you couple that with job growth and both urban areas that companies can, can make profits, that foreign investment is going to come back into the country. Those are things that is the number one issue that Prime Minister Opposite is facing. The second issue, in fact, his government, I believe, is more adept than any of the most recent previous governments of, let's say, the last 4 or 5 years, is to deal with the Muslim insurgency in the southern part of the country. Thailand is predominantly a Buddhist nation, about 92% or thereabouts of the nation is Buddhist. A very small Christian minority, about 0.5%. But there is a small but significant Muslim minority, and they represent about 6% of the population. And so you're talking about maybe between 3 and 4 million people in the deep part of the south. There has been an insurgency there. There has been a lot of violence. In the last 4 years, there have been over 8,500 violent incidents, almost 3,500 people killed. The Democrats have a base in Bangkok, but they also have a base in southern Thailand, and that is they are much more popular than former Prime Minister Thaksin and his successors, who had very repressive policies towards that minority. And so, trying to work and to abate with the violence there, I'm hoping that they can be successful and be accomplished, because it really has been a problem for the nation for the last 4 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, let me introduce our guest, John Brandon. He's director of the Asia Foundation's International Relations Programs. He's also associate director of their Washington, D.C. office. He is a Southeast Asia specialist by his training. We're talking this morning about Thailand and what's been going on there recently. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. Here where we are, we do also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, wherever the signal will travel, or you might happen to be listening on the Internet across the country. In any case, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. I'm wondering what kind of significance what we've been talking about here has outside of Thailand, and particularly whether it has significance for the ability of Thailand to be to exercise leadership within the region.
That's a very good point. Thailand is now the head, or is now the chair of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. It's a regional grouping that comprises the 10 countries of Southeast Asia. And Thailand has been the chair for the past 6 months, and it will continue throughout 2009. They were supposed to have their leaders' meeting on December 15th, but given all the unrest, the closing of the airport, there was no way that they could possibly be able to have the meeting, and so it was postponed till March. The leaders were supposed to sign what they call the ASEAN Charter, making sort of almost like the region's constitution, that it would make it more of a rules-based organization. It's important to note that Southeast Asia is a very diverse part of the world, not only culturally and ethnically and religious diversity, but also political and economic diversity. A country like Singapore has the second highest per capita income of any country in all of Asia, with the exception of Japan. And you have a country like Thailand, where per capita income is probably between, $4,000 and $5,000, considered a middle-income country, but still developing. And then you have very poor countries like Laos, Cambodia, Burma, also known as Myanmar, which make about $250 to $300. The average person makes $250 to $300 a year. And so how do if you're trying to lead this group under a charter that's rules-based, where some countries may be inclined not to follow all the rules, a country like Burma, Myanmar, and Thailand being preoccupied with its own political difficulties, it's going to make it very difficult for the political leadership of that country to be able to focus on it when they're looking more internally.
It seems that this is a place where politics really moves on personal relationships and also people's calculations of gain and loss when it comes to their alliances. And it sounds as if that's what Thai politics has been like for some time now. It doesn't sound like that's particularly likely to change.
Well, it did for a period of time. There was a constitution passed in 1997 that I believe of the 18 constitutions in Thailand's history since constitutional history since 1932. The 1997 one was the most democratic. But there was a person, a friend of mine said to me when I was in Thailand a few years back, he says, John, Thaksin has been able to manipulate, this whole process, and that he's been able to think 5 minutes ahead of everyone else in the country. And so the fact that he was able to sort of emasculate sort of these checks and balances that in the 1997 Constitution really was very unfortunate. Instead of playing by the rules where people could you know, where there would be checks and balances. There'd be an honest sort of back and forth in terms of debate on the public policy issues of the day. That wound up not happening. Thaksin, you know, dictated more. And now what we have after the last couple of years with a military coup, with a revised constitution where some of the 1997 constitution was kept but other parts were not, I see in Thailand, at least in the short and medium term, a series of weak, ineffective coalition governments. I hope I'm wrong about this government. But with that said, I think there are a number of daunting challenges that Prime Minister Abhisit is going to face in the political infighting. Just the one fellow that I told you, the power broker, Nawin Chibchob, if for some reason he were to go back and jump to another political party because it would be advantageous to him and his followers, then that government would fall and then another one would be created. And so the 97 Constitution was hopefully – they were hoping that it would narrow down to two, maybe three political parties, and that would be it. And there's a plethora of political parties in Thailand. Yeah.
That I recall having read a story about that man in particular who had been an important supporter of Thaksin Shinawatra, and I don't know if that's apocryphal or this actually took place about a telephone call between the two men, where the man who was the sort of the godfather, the power broker, said to him, "Oh, here I have it. It's something. It was reported here on the BBC. Nawin Chibchob was talking with Thaksin Shinawatra, and he said, quote, 'It's over, boss.'" He said it was essentially saying, "Okay, this is the way it's going now, and I'm jumping to the other side." But of course, as you say, that he could, after a while, if he thought it was to his advantage, he could very easily abandon the current coalition.
And also note that he called him, you know, that he didn't refer to him as Khun Thaksin or Mr. Thaksin. He referred to him as boss. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, I guess he could always. He could always go back. And I would never underestimate a person, even though he's living outside the country, with billions of dollars. And you never know how things could be manipulated, that he could conceivably come back to power either I mean, he's technically legally banned, and he's a fugitive right now. But that doesn't mean that – and he did this for a period of time after he left – military coup up until fairly recently, being able to wield significant influences through proxies in the country.
So I'm assuming that he is still doing that.
He is trying to do it. Absolutely, and I'm sure that he's looking at you know, these 30 seats that where there'll be a by-election, and how that could possibly. Change the calculus of how the government might look depending on those results and within the next couple of months.
So what sort of significance does this have for the United States?
Well, the United States and Thailand have had a longstanding an uninterrupted bilateral relationship. Actually, this past year, Thailand and the United States celebrated 175 years of bilateral relations. The relationship began in 1833 under the presidency of Andrew Jackson. It has been a staunch ally. Thailand is still a treaty ally. Our bilateral trade is about $25 billion a year, two-way trade. It has, for a period of time, it did send non-combatant troops to Iraq. It has been supportive of, or the United States has supported programs that try to curb drug trafficking in the country. And in terms of heroin, it has been very successful in that regard. Is now working to try to stop trafficking of women and children throughout the region, where sometimes Thailand can be a transit point for that, as well as within inside the country. And so there are important bilateral issues, but I think probably people are puzzled by what's been happening inside the country. And when you couple that with the economic difficulties the United States is facing, plus the foreign policy challenges of of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, North Korea. Thailand doesn't resonate as highly on as a first tier issue, but I think because of the long-standing historical relationship, I think the United States would try to help when it can. But I don't think it wants to interfere in the politics of the country. I mean, those decisions have to be made by the Thai people themselves.
Mm-hmm. So just to talk about what's likely to happen here in the near term, we talked about the fact that that there is a coalition now of people who have come together perhaps for a variety of reasons to support Mr. Opposite, who has now become prime minister. But this, in as little as about 3 weeks, this could come apart, or at least maybe the first big test comes in January, when there would be elections to fill those seats that had been held by supporters of Thaksin Shinawatra, who were kicked out essentially by this court ruling that disbanded his party and said those party members can't participate now in politics for a period of time. So the question is, well, you know, what happens with the balance of the parliament when they fill these seats, and who ends up winning those seats?
Well, if they win those seats, then if they won each of the 30 seats, they would have more votes than the 235 that Prime Minister Opposite and the Democratic Party currently hold. It's currently 235 seats for the coalition, 166 of those being members of the Democratic Party, against versus 198. So if the 30 seats up for in the by-election, all of them were to be won, that would bump them up to 238, and it would give them a very small majority. And would they then be luring people away to, to solidify that? And as we said, we saw Naywin Chitchope and his group jump from the People's Power Party to now, the Democrats. Will he jump and his followers jump back? That's a very, very big question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we'll continue to watch. I appreciate you giving us some of your time and helping us to get better understanding about what has been happening there over the past months. Our guest is John Brandon. He is the director of the Asia Foundation's International Relations Programs. He is also associate director of their Washington, D.C. office, speaking to us this morning from there by phone. And Mr. Brandon, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois on the web at tnol.com. Support for the broadcast today also comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save costs and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information is available online at wardenmartin.com, or you can call 352-8910. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we will look back to a Supreme Court case that was one of the first that had to do with religion and public education. This was 1948, and the case came out of Champaign, Illinois. It began as a challenge to a program of religious instruction that was held in public schools during school time and ended up putting one local family at the center of a national controversy. We'll be talking with Dan McCollum, someone who has certainly been involved in politics here in our area for some time, served as mayor of the city of Champaign. This is the story of his family, his mother, and one of his brothers, and he tells it in a newly published book that he's written. The title of his book is The Lord Was Not on Trial. It tells the story of his family and their experiences in this precedent-setting case, and he'll be with us in the next hour, Focus 580, to talk about it. First, though, as we usually do at this time, we'll be taking a break so we can bring you news from National Public Radio and an update on the commodity markets, so please stay tuned.
And today, with the outside markets, particularly the U.S. dollar, which has shown a little bit of strength today, currently trading on my screen at 81.37. The 100-day moving average continues to provide some overhead resistance against that mark. that 100-day moving average coming in at 81.60 and 4 tenths at the moment. But the firming of the dollar is having some underlying support at the Chicago Board of Trade in the corn pit, where we're seeing prices a little bit firmer at this hour. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. March corn at 384.5 is up 2.75. May, 394.75, up 2.75. July, 405.5, up 3. December, 429.5, up 2.5. January beans, 889, up 2.5. March, 892.5, up 2. July, 914.5, up 2. November of 2009, 9.15¾, down a half. January soybean meal, 275.70, up 20. January soybean oil, 30.84, down 10. The wheat pit at the Board of Trade, March at 560.25, down 8.75. July, 584.25.